Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Welcome to episode 8 of the podcast. In this episode and in the one that follows, because this is going to be a two-parter because of the length of the conversation, we're going to delve into the history of our sport. Along with the business side of things that I mentioned in the last episode, the history is something that I also want to make part of these conversations because I think it's an important thing that not only should we as coaches understand, but it's an element of the sport that too often our players don't appreciate. And to be fair, if we don't appreciate it ourselves and we're not sharing that with our players, then how can we really truly expect them to grasp it and take hold of it the way it's probably worth them doing to help pull the sport forward and increase enthusiasm and all of that sort of stuff. So I originally proposed this idea with Mark Levadue because he's really interested in the history of the sport and has done a lot of work on looking back at old matches and understanding old systems of play and all these sorts of things. So when we talked about it, he immediately suggested that we bring Sue Kozanski in, which I thought was a great idea on a couple of levels. First, obviously, Sue has a long story career, 39 seasons coaching at UC Riverside at the AIAW and NCAA levels, won 3 national championships, has coached at a bunch of different levels. Right now she's coaching, I believe it's high school boys. She's an AVCA Hall of Fame inductee. She does coaching instruction for FIVB and for USA Volleyball. She's written a couple of books. So there's no question of her credentials talking about the history of especially coaching development in our sport and the sport overall. And it's always a lot of fun having Mark and Sue together. If you recall the original Coaching Conversation series, there was an episode where, again, the three of us were talking, and this time on the subject of creativity and coaching. I always love having conversations with the two of them, going back to an FIVB coaching seminar that we were all at in England, and I believe it was in 2015, where Sue was there presenting on, I think it was setting, and Mark was there presenting on outside hitting. And it tied in with Volleyball England's annual coaching conference. So I was there to take part in. And at the end, as part of the Volleyball England stuff, the coaching conference stuff, the two of them were on stage together, and it was just a really funny, great conversation, which then led on to Mark interviewing Sue for the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project, which was also a really good conversation. So it's a lot of fun having the two of them together, and I think that'll come through in what you hear in this episode and also the next one. We went something like, an hour and a half or so in our conversation. So rather than making one really long episode, I decided to split it up into two slightly more consumable episodes. So I think, you'll have a lot of fun with this. We go all over the place, which is what tends to happen, but that's the idea of a conversation. This isn't a lecture. This isn't the story of volleyball. This is us bringing up a bunch of sometimes seemingly random stuff that happened in the sport. But hopefully it'll be stuff that you haven't necessarily heard about before, or maybe you haven't thought about in a long time. And it'll encourage you to maybe want to dig in further into the history of the sport. And on a related note, this kind of an early part of the conversation where we're discussing this idea of kind of the pioneers of the sport in the United States, being the group of coaches in the kind of the latter 60s and into the 70s, and maybe even into the early 80s, who really took it upon themselves to learn the sport and to learn how to be coaches kind of together. And there's a lot of names, and Mark lists a bunch of names, so I'll spread it out here. But that whole idea is foundational to something I'm working on with McKaylee on the Volleyball Coaching Wizards side of things, where he's going to be interviewing a lot of those people to get their stories so we can hear from all different perspectives how that all ties together and how they collectively came to influence each other, get influences from outside, and share, become basically, I call them pioneers because they kind of created the foundation of modern volleyball, especially in the United States. But to the degree that U.S. volleyball has extended its influence abroad, around the world, that as well. So that generation of coaches are the heavily influential on the coaches today, either directly from having worked with us or indirectly from having worked with people that we worked with, kind of the whole idea of the coaching tree. So again, I think you'll enjoy it. We'd love to hear your comments, suggestions for discussions down the line, because I definitely want to do more of these and all that. So enjoy. I suppose we should kind of prep this where we want to go with it. Mark and I were talking about this a little earlier. Well, not a little earlier, but when this whole idea first came up, Mark, you basically had no interest in just going through a history lesson, just like, hey, this is the history of volleyball, blah, blah, blah. But we wanted to focus more on specific events, influential events. Am I correct in that interpretation?
I think you might have gone in a little bit more than I'd intended. I definitely didn't want to go through some historical, some like,
Yeah, lecture, overview, yeah, survey course.
And when the topic came up, I just thought, well, if we're going to have some conversation about history, then it's a really good excuse to talk to Sue. So
There
that's literally as far down the rabbit hole as I've gone on that.
Well, I'm glad I was included.
The object was to include you. So the topic is, John can worry about the topic.
Okay. Well, I don't think we need to go through a list of the, one, two, three, four. I think we can look at that.
Yeah. Well, and you expressed an interest in talking about the women's side of the sport and how that evolved kind of through the AIAW years. So basically into the early 80s.
About an interest in talking about me.
Well, so let's ask this question, Mark. If we're talking about, if Sue talks about the women's side of the game in the 60s and 70s, do you have counterpoints, on the men's side in the international game?
Maybe, but I was about to say the thing that the thing that interests me is the and we've had versions of this conversation where the period in the development of sport of volleyball in America, obviously, when there was a group of really dedicated, inspired, engaged coaches who taught themselves volleyball, basically, and taught each other volleyball.
Right.
So it's the conversations that I've had with Sue at different times about getting in the car, driving for 8 hours to go to some clinic in,
Iowa.
So the thing that interests me is the community of coaches who that particular group of coaches, and if I understand it, it includes, it's Sue obviously, but it's Bill Dunphy, Neville McGowan, Haley Liskevich, on a really wide range of coaches who I was going to say who taught themselves and each other. Volleyball, and who then had a massive influence over the next 50 years of world volleyball, basically.
Right. Yeah.
I agree, and I think that's a definite thing to mention, because I think that was the grassroots development of volleyball in the States.
Well, where we can, not, it didn't develop everything in the world, but it had a really outsized influence, probably through Doug, but all of those people had some part in that whole movement that created the way that we play volleyball on the men's side now.
So you can answer this. Does it make sense to start with Jim Coleman?
Oh, Coleman. Yeah, sorry. I forgot the king.
Well, he's definitely, within that group and definitely did a lot internationally in a lot of different areas. In fact, probably he did more internationally, working with the men's national teams, because he just by virtue of the situation didn't have as much influence in the women's college game, because he just wasn't at colleges that were given many resources or anything. And he was huge in my life also.
Yeah, because he's the one. For all the people that Mark just mentioned, they almost all of them go back and say, yeah, I learned a ton from Jim, or I worked with Jim, or Jim was great in this. And not all of them necessarily overlap with him, but they certainly, those who did interacted with all the other ones. So right. he for sure had a huge influence.
He definitely wanted to share. He was just always about, sharing his information with everyone.
Well, okay. So how about we do this as a kind of a starting point? Can you describe what the environment was like during those years when all these coaches were kind of starting to get the bug, I guess you could say, and connect with each other and seek to learn from themselves, but also from outside resources, whether it be Korean coaches, Russian coaches, whoever it was at the time?
Well, as Mark began to say, I think one of the early ways that all of us learned as coaches was in this great group of coaches that during the summers we would do Olympic volleyball camps all over the country. And we would fly there or drive there. And Doug Beal was in coaching, and Bill Neville and Terry Laskavich and Jim Coleman, and all of us would go to one camp and we would teach a session and listen to what everyone else had to say. And then we would go off and teach that. So whatever information maybe Jim had internationally or Doug had internationally, they would bring that back home. We would learn it from them. And then we would all begin teaching. And I think the key in those days was, which may be slightly different than today, is the passion that coaches had and how much they were willing to share with each other so that we all became better coaches. So there was it was a family, it was a community of coaches that really worked together to make volleyball strong in the States.
And there was no money in it, so no little fiefdoms.
Right. So your motivation, which I see a difference today, is there was very little money involved. So those people that were involved simply because they had a passion for the game, wanted to be involved for no other reason than they loved volleyball and they loved teaching and coaching.
Back in the, not that things have changed massively at this point, but back in those days, it's my impression, I was not around, so I can't speak to this directly, that the sport was incredibly regionalized in the country. You obviously had the West Coast, Southern California especially, and there are many stories about the conflict in the men's national team. I don't know if this showed up in the women's national team as well, between those guys and the guys from the Midwest, which was more Beal's country. That's McKaylee came from that area with Ball State and all of that. How was that on the women's side, for that matter? I mean, was it similar or was there less of a factor?
To a degree, it was similar in the college ranks. But when in the early 80s and late 70s, when our national women's national teams were forming, it was a group of two different groups. And one was from California and one was a little bit more from other areas of the country. So Chuck Irby led the group from out in this area in California, and Ari Selinger was working with another group, and he had a training site, you know, in Texas. And in for the 84 Olympics, when everything really caught on and the group got really strong, those two teams joined each other. So there was right away in 84, there was a combination of people from different areas of the country. And that's the strength of the 84 team that won the silver medal. In the colleges, it was different. And we won a lot at UC Riverside in Division II because people were afraid of us. So when we played somebody, even if they were a little bit better, we won because they already felt we would win because we were from California and we were a stronger team. And to the NCAA's credit, and we didn't like it at the time, but because they formed the different regions and made sure that there was an avenue to reach the nationals by each region team came and became much stronger when they saw the quality of the other teams. And they grew and learned from this competition with people from all over the country. And eventually, then the strength grew through clubs also, but the strength changed. So for our national team, it was a little less regionalized from the beginning.
Can I ask it?
Yeah.
Because that what you touched on with the two training centers was actually one of the ideas that I had in my head. So it's the mid-70s. So am I right? Sort of somewhere around 75, 76. And there were two full-time training centers, one coached by Ari Selinger and one coached by
Chuck Irby.
Where did the funding for that come from? What was the kind of inspiration, the background for that?
Chuck Irby's team, which was the one that I was more knowledgeable about because they were from the Anaheim area here in California, Debbie Green's father started the organization, and he did all the funding himself. They went door to door. They sold tickets for matches that they would have. And they played in the USA volleyball, which was USVBA at that time. And they played in tournaments. But that was totally funded by them, by their club. And Debbie Green's father wanted Debbie Green, who became the international setter, who was one of our top setters and became one of our good coaches at Long Beach State. He was the one that had the vision of it. And I'm not sure how he became friends with Chuck Irby, but Chuck Irby went to Korea and early on, before he started coaching that team, and learned the game. And he was not a volleyball player. In fact, he had difficulty doing the coaching skills, which was popular at that time. So he came back, and Debbie Green's father and Chuck Irby formed that team, got their own funding, and that's how that went. And they went as a team to the 76 Olympics and played many of the international teams because, of course, the U.S. didn't qualify in 76. So they just got better and better and better. And then on the other side of the country, Ari Selinger, who had coached in Israel, so he was an established coach at that time, started the other team. And Pasadena, Texas, where they trained for many years, that was sponsored by, partially by the city.
Okay. So,
no, go ahead.
So Ari was already in America and or he was brought to America to coach their team?
I believe he was already here. And I think he may have come here because he wanted to be the coach of the U.S. women's team. And at that time, it was separate. Eventually, he did become the coach.
Yes.
And the two teams were brought together.
And before that, they were pretty competitive with each other, I imagine.
I think so, yes. And if you compare the players that played on each team, yes, they were all good. But when you put those two teams together, they became really very strong. Obviously, they almost won the gold in 84.
Yeah.
It, structurally, looking at the landscape of volleyball in the U.S. right now, it strikes me how interesting those separations were. In men's volleyball, well, in both men's and women's volleyball, West Coast was obviously very big, very strong for many, many years. And it took a while for the rest of the country to catch up. But you had in men's volleyball, West Coast, and then Midwest, Indiana, Illinois, Chicago, Ohio, that sort of cluster. You know, the Ball States, the Ohio States, that's where Mick Haley came from, Shondell and his kids, you know, and progeny after that. But I hadn't realized the Texas connection, which helps to explain why Texas is so massive for women's volleyball. And, you know, but there's practically no boys volleyball. And there really never has been, as far as I understand it. You know, maybe it's starting to make some inroads now. But it took Nebraska and what Terry Pettit did with that program to really pull kind of the center of volleyball as it is now, well, and actually Mick with his Texas team, away from the West Coast in the late 80s in terms of the NCAA. Now, if you go back AIAW, Texas was already influential at that point, but you didn't have the Penn States or the Nebraskas or any of the other Midwestern teams that were the powerhouses that they've become.
I think another element to this in Texas in the early 70s when the AIAW had just formed, Mary Jo Pepler, who's a pretty big name in early volleyball, she was one of the great players, probably the best player that the U.S. women had in those early days, because of her physical stature and her competitiveness. But she was in Texas with Marilyn McGreevy at Sol Ross University.
Mm-hmm.
They won an AIW national championship there, and they formed a team with a lot of those players that ended up being on that Ari Selinger team originally.
Okay.
And then they went Pasadena, Texas, and I'm not sure if the team was together at this point. The two teams may have been together when they went to the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. So they were there training for the Olympics before they came back to California to train. But because of that connection at the training center, they were already out of California or out of Texas. So that helped bring in a few other players. And then the last element that I think is important is that the USA Volleyball put together a coaching accreditation program. And that was the early 80s, 84, 85, 86, where the idea was any player that wanted to be a good player had that opportunity because they had strong coaches anywhere in the country. That coaching program was to help bring in players from everywhere. And on the women's side, I think it happened a lot quicker.
Right, with the help of Title IX, of course.
That too, but with it was all those elements tied together, because USA Volleyball got the coaching accreditation program, which got people that were knowledgeable about volleyball all over the country. So then those people could coach. And with Title IX, there were programs more available, but we needed coaches that knew about volleyball because volleyball was just really in its initial stages. So you needed somebody to be able to teach.
Mark, you're smiling at this. Yes, goes through your head.
Oh no, I'm smiling because it's an obvious solution that the first contact that people have with volleyball is their coach, and that coaches are the ones that drive the building of the sport. It was something that we never met, that we never got in Australia. We never went at it from that direction. And I remember really a conversation, a breakfast coaches meeting with, his name was Lindsay Gaze. He was the most famous Australian basketball coach. His son was the greatest player. He played 1 year in Seton Hall and made the final. But we asked how they developed. Basketball was big and Australian basketball was good, much better than they should be. So, you know, we have top five, top six in the world, more or less, for the last 40 years, some version of that. And we asked him what they did, and they said that, like, the pioneer said, all right, we need to have places to play. And they put all of their resources into building venues, places for people to play, and coaches, the first contact of people with the sport being coaches. And that was the thing that drove the quality of the quantity and also the quality of the Australian basketball, which I think we have 10 guys in the NBA right now, something ridiculous. So,
wow.
Yeah. And we didn't manage that in volleyball, but American volleyball seems to, maybe they went about it that way.
Well, and to that, I mean, just my experience in England is very similar, where it clearly was participation, 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 and they didn't think too deeply about how to the need to develop coaches until much later in the game. And I think it's suffered as a result structurally, but small country. The thing that came to my mind, Sue, you know, we talked Title IX and getting more coaches involved. At what point did the imbalance between the male side of the sport and the female side of the sport start to develop, where the women just took off and got way out ahead?
I think it was just that way from the beginning, and unfortunately, it's just going to take men a long time to catch up because of the dynamics of the financial situation and the colleges and tradition of different sports in the United States, where basketball and baseball and football are just the top sports. But I do see a change coming because there are more and more high school programs. But for the women, volleyball was always a sport that just needed to have, as Mark's saying, needed to have the opportunities, needed to have the venues. And when that happened, it was the perfect sport for women. And the colleges definitely made the biggest difference at the beginning. But once colleges had strong programs, then clubs became the next biggest influence, and the combination of the two is just incredible, because the combination of the two has just taken us over the top, where really women's volleyball now is a bigger, slightly bigger participation sport for women than even women's basketball. Mm-hmm. See that continuing to grow, and with the popularity of women volleyball and beach volleyball, where the men really shine, I think eventually men's volleyball will take a big step forward, and possibly when football, if football ever changes because of the concussions and the danger of playing, perhaps that will be the biggest turning point.
Yeah, it was for a long time volleyball is considered a girls' sport. I think, and Mark, you've got more, you know, broad base of exposure to the game than I do, but It seems like in places it's still considered that.
When I grew up in volleyball, there was definitely a it wasn't called a girl sport in the way that it is in America. It was called a girl sport, perhaps in a
derogatory,
more pejorative, sexist sense. But definitely, you know, when I grew up in Australia, even soccer was something that was considered, un-Australian, if you even want to call it that. So, volleyball had some of that to fight against, but even then, it was so small that it didn't really matter. But volleyball in Australia, like soccer, was a sport of migrants at the beginning. So it was brought to Australia by the influx of displaced persons and refugees who came from Eastern Europe, particularly after the war. And to link it back to basketball, it was the same in some ways, the same communities that started basketball, soccer, volleyball in Australia, the Latvians, Yugoslavians, Serbians, Estonians, sort of those communities.
Can't forget the Russians. I bring that up because your dad was obviously involved.
My dad is Russian. He was involved, but it wasn't. Russians weren't big. They were a bigger community, but they weren't such a driving force in the sport development. So the Baltic states were really, really big in basketball and volleyball, for example.
Well, so. I haven't heard it talked about a lot, but I think maybe the women's volleyball has had the advantage of the men not being involved at the beginning, because people look at women's volleyball as a sport where they can see this is how it's played, and this is great spectator sport. They don't compare it to basketball. For example, men's basketball, when I look at women's basketball, I'm thinking, why can't these women do all the things that the men can do? And a lot of people do compare it that way. But when you look at volleyball, you don't compare it to the men. Maybe those of us that are coaching at a higher level, but basically we're looking at volleyball as the game of volleyball, and it's pretty exciting to watch. So I think we've had the advantage of men at the beginning not being involved, and now we're well established. So men being involved will only help us, because it'll become more popular as a sport in general.
That's really interesting. I never would have thought about it like that, that there was less opportunity to compare negatively the two things. But I wonder, like, from having talked to you at different times, I have the impression that that early community of coaches actually had a relatively large proportion of women. Is that fair, or is it just because I know you?
I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're saying.
My feeling, my understanding is that early community of coaches that we talked about, who traveled around doing the clinics, that there were actually quite a few female coaches in that group, perhaps more than you might imagine.
I'm trying to think of who those women were, because I don't really recall a lot of women in that.
Okay. I could be wrong. Also,
No. You could be right, but I don't remember a lot of women being involved, because I was thinking for this conversation, who were the top women that have been involved in the growth of volleyball? And I can think of a lot of the women after 1984 that were involved because of their playing careers, but I can't think of a lot of women that were involved early on. The women that were involved early on in getting either volleyball or just women's sports going were women in positions in the colleges where they were fighting for Title IX and they were fighting for better programs and better coaches, but those weren't people that were strictly involved in volleyball. And the sad in the early days is that many of the women that helped get women's sports where they are today were sort of taken out of their positions because they didn't have the background of the expertise in sports that grew because of them, but they didn't always get the advantage of being involved after they created something bigger than they were.
Okay. You mentioned Mary Jo Pepler before was one, and while you were talking, another name that springs to mind was Jill Gregory. Is that right?
Kathy Gregory was a long time.
Gregory.
Yeah.
Was it that time or later?
Well, Mary Jo Pepler was sort of the ringleader at the beginning, but her assistant and a player that played in the 1970 championships where I played was Marilyn McGreevy, and Marilyn McGreevy did stay involved for many years, so she was involved. But Kathy Gregory, as you mentioned, yes, because Kathy played on the national teams early, and then after the national teams, she became she played on the beach and was a great beach player, very influential on the beach. And then she got the job coaching at University of California, Santa Barbara, and coached there for over 30 years. So she was definitely one of the pioneers of coaching. And for a while, she did some commentaries on the radio, and she is a funny person. She has just a great personality, different personality. And I think I wish she would be on the radio more, doing more of the announcing for volleyball, because I think if she did, that could promote volleyball in itself, get more people involved.
Some of the other names, Ruth Nelson was obviously involved in those years. What about Nina Matthews?
Yes.
Other ones too.
After Kathy Gregory, but she was on the national team just a little bit afterwards, and she was at Pepperdine for,
years. A long time.
So, a great beach player, so she was influential in that area also, yes.
And also in getting college women's volleyball started, as I understand it. With the help of the ABCA.
So we do have a few. So we have managed to think of a few names.
Okay, well, and a few more, just Debbie Green, because after she really was a pioneer as a player, she was the setting coach at Long Beach State and very successful there. Sue Woodstra also did some coaching and was influential. And Paula Wyckoff, probably one of the better known names, helped Mick Haley at USC when they won a couple national championships. And then she went on to coach at University of California, Irvine, and now is at Concordia. So she is still coaching.
Yeah, I saw something just recently, some interview or some conversation with her.
Yeah, Brian DiMolaro likes to joke about how he blackmailed Debbie and Rita to come be his assistants. And promised it was only going to be 1 year. And Rita did end up leaving, but Debbie stuck around forever.
And because her daughter ended up going to school at Long Beach, we stayed while her daughter was there setting. And then when her other daughter went to UC Santa Barbara, then Debbie Green went to Santa Barbara to help with Kathy Gregory. So Debbie really did a great job and was involved for a long time. And two other people that probably most people have not heard about, but I think were very influential in the college game in volleyball, was Dixie Grimmett and Ann Hecht. They were the two volleyball coaches at Long Beach State before Brian DiMolaro, and Dixie or Ann that won the first national championship for volleyball in AIAW at Long Beach State. So there are names that people don't know about, but they were influential.
Well, and that's an important point, because AIAW was in place until, what, 82? Am I right when it transitioned to NCAA?
81.
Okay, so there's...
No,
there's a lot of history that people have heard about NCAA, but that misses out on all. For example, Texas became the first non-West Coast team when Mick was in charge in, what, 88, I think it was, to win an NCAA national championship. They had actually won an AIAW championship in the late 70s, I think it was, or early 80s. So even earlier than that, you know, even back then, there was a bit more diversity of talent in the women's game that we may not think about now because of who was winning those early NCAA championships, because it was always USC or UCLA or Pacific or, you know, all the West Coast teams, Hawaii as well.
And in the early years of AIW, it wasn't a Final Four or a Final Eight. It was a one national championship of 24 teams. So representatives came from all over the country, and then you had this huge tournament, like a world championship with pool play, and then the winners continued to go on. But that was another way of bringing people together from different regions and giving them an opportunity to see the game. So whereas I, as a coach, was against that because in California we had so many top teams, and therefore you might be number one and two in the country, but you wouldn't even be able to go to nationals because you lost in regional play. The AIW and the NCAA early on, because of those tournaments and forcing really the regional tournaments to be the way that you got to nationals, that was helping volleyball along the way. So it really was the reason that it's better. And AIW definitely started it. And until, because I was involved with that at an administrative level also, until the AIW became really, really strong and there were national championships in 19 different sports, and we were starting to get television rights, at that point, NCAA took over. So in 1981, they decided that women really were interested in competing. They didn't know that before.
Well, and when was it that the NCAA finally adopted their own women's volleyball rulebook instead of National Association of Girls and Women's Sports, right? It was that, because I remember that was still going on in the early 2000s. I don't remember when it got switched.
Yeah, so that was all a benefit. The negative thing now is in those days, every organization had a rule book. Yeah. And that's why we have way too many rules in the United States, that has their rules and colleges have their rules, and men are different than women collegiately because they use international rules. Very confusing.
Yeah. Thoughts on that, Mark? I know this is not stuff that you were ever involved in.
Different rules. I mean, I understand how different, especially when things are regional based and you have, have local rules. That's sort of a little bit normal. But I have to say, I don't really understand how it is that women's sport or college, women's college, for example, hasn't got to the point where they say, okay, we play international rules the same as everybody else. But it's a little bit of how non-Americans look at Americans, and the NBA world champions, and our rules are always different. And so I'm a little bit biased in that way.
Yeah, and I know there's discussions among coaches now about, can you change that, and maybe it's different for Division I than it is for Division II and Division III because the focus points are different. The lower levels participation is a bigger deal, which is factors into roster sizes. And so if you're carrying big rosters, then being able to use more substitutes kind of has a logic to it, to keep people happy, agree or, you know, whether you like it or not. It's one of the things that the NC went away from, and I don't remember exactly when this happened in Division One, was the regionalization. They went to, it's not a fully seeded tournament like it is in basketball. And they still try to, they don't call it regionalization, but it's kind of effectively that in the first, in the early rounds, because they try to minimize the travel. But in Division Two and Division Three, it's still very regionalized. And it still has the problems that you brought up, Sue, about, like in Division Two, where I coached for a couple of years, the teams in the upper Northwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, extremely, the Northern Sun Conference produces national championships seemingly every year, every other year. And we'll have five of the top 10 teams in the country in any given year, but only one of them can make it to the national championship. Just like you were talking about. Whereas obviously in Division One, it's much more wide open, and structured differently. Okay. We'll cut the conversation at this point and resume next week. Actually, Sue is just about ready to line Mark up with a question about the women's game and what he think would make it more enjoyable, because as we all know, well, we don't all know, but as some of us know, Mark is not as big a fan of women's volleyball as he is of the men's game. But anyway, and Sue knows this, so she's kind of lining him up for it. And I think you probably enjoy the response. Apologies for some of the sound quality issues for Sue. Trying to clean that up as much as possible. But, you know, you got to deal with what you can. Hopefully it was understandable. And hopefully you'll be back to enjoy next week's episode. So we'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingvb.com, for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog of prior coaching conversation. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingvb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingvb.com, tweet them to @coachingvb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.